Good morning. How's everybody doing? Did you guys have a good plenary session? Okay. All right. They asked us to kind of get started a little bit later, which is what we're doing right now because of the overtime that was happening down in the other end of the building. But my name is Jody Rave, and I've been a longtime working journalist, and I'm working on a book right now, but I'm an environmental studies graduate student here at the university. But I'm very honored to be with you this morning and talk with you about tribal energy issues and how that pertains to climate. Right now, we have three panelists listed. One of our panelists had a medical condition, but Rod McDonald will be stepping in to fill that space. Pat Spears, who is also listed on our agenda, is finding a parking space. So he'll be here shortly. And we're going to start off with Gail Small, who is another added panelist that, being here in Montana, it was, I think it's imperative that we have a Native person. She's Northern Cheyenne, from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation over on the other side of the state. So I asked her to please join us and share some of her perspectives. She can give you the details of the work that she's done working with the environment. I'd say her whole life has been dedicated to these issues, and she's the executive director of Native Action, and she has also been a she was the elected member for the Tribal Council of the Northern Cheyenne. And our next guest is Alexis Bonagoski, and she is the Tribal Lands Coordinator with the National Wildlife Federation. She is in a very interesting situation in that of the big environmental groups in the United States, the National Wildlife Federation has one of the few programs directed specifically they have a tribal lands program. So she's going to talk with us about some of the work that the Tribal Lands Project is doing through the National Wildlife Federation. And we have Rod McDonald, who has spent the last 15 years. Oh, he found his parking spot. That's great. Come on in, Pat. I told him he would be here shortly, and just like you, there you were. Rod McDonald has spent the last 15 years as he spent 15 years as a working journalist, and he recently, it's actually been several years now, 4 years, that he is the communications director for the Confederated and Salish Kootenai tribes up on the Flathead Reservation. I don't know if any of you did the tour up on the Flathead, but you may have met Rod on it. And our final panelist is Pat Spears, who is with Intertribal Coup. He's also the president of Intertribal Coup and a co-founder, and he also is a board member of Native Energy. So he's going to share some of his perspectives on renewable energy on tribal lands. And in our order, we'll start off with Gail Small, go to Alexis. Pat, you will be third, and then we'll round off with Rob McDonald. So let's get started.
Good morning. Hello, Anna. What's done? I'm Gail Small from the Northern Cheyenne Tribe across the state of Montana, and I'm a member of Native Action, which is a nonprofit organization. I'd like to begin a little bit with just some of the work I've done to acquaint you with environmental justice work in Indian Country, and then I'll kind of lay the context and hopefully provide some ideas that I think that as journalists you might be interested in following up on. I went to school here at the University of Montana years ago, and I love this part of the state. It's always good to be back here, and I really see this land as the Salish Kootenai's people's land. I have very good friends here in this area. One thing you'll find in working with Indian tribes is we're a very tight-knit people. We're many different tribes, but it's a very small community. So like we all know each other. So we know who's up and what's going on. So, you know, if you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. So we're a tight-knit group. The work I started out doing really kind of was precipitated by, you know, growing up on the reservation. We appreciate the land. The land is beautiful. It has a lot of cultural ties. You know, there's a tremendous sense of spirituality among Indians, and we're tied to their home base, where we're from. And I remember Wilma Mankiller came up to my reservation a couple years ago before she got real ill. And I was showing her around, and she said, "It just amazes me, Gail. She can say, 'Oh, my grandma's buried over here, and this is where we're over here picking berries. This is where we dig our turnips over here.'" And she said, "You guys are just part of your land." So that's real significant to us. And so when I was in high school, the largest coal strip mine in the United States was being proposed right around my reservation. Actually, they had proposed power plants directly through our lands. And they promised us a lot of wealth. We were all going to become millionaires overnight because we're a small tribe. You know, there's only about 4,000 members of us at the time. And our reservation is underlain heavily by huge deposits, billions of tons of very valuable coal. And so the reservation was very much in crisis. It kind of reminds me of this tar sands crisis that we're going through right now, where they're bringing in this heavy equipment and they're opening up that whole area. You know, I was only about 15 when this happened, and all the young Cheyennes actually went down, and we stood in front of these huge bulldozers and stuff that were trying to go into our high country. We literally stopped them from coming into our land. And it was a deal where the Bureau of Indian Affairs had leased out our reservation land for 17 cents a ton. It was a total ripoff. It was less than what we were getting for our rocks, for our shale and our gravel at the time. So, you know, it became kind of a real time when I became very much an activist of young people on the reservation. And so as a consequence, our tribe held it off. We went to court. We went to Congress. And we won. It was a remarkable victory. In fact, we stopped all federal public coal leasing in the United States as a result of our lawsuit. We found 36 illegalities of all public land law as well as environmental law. And it really hit, I think, pushed Indian tribes into a very proactive mode of sovereignty over their lands. That we clearly have the authority as tribal governments to pass our own laws. We have our own tribal environmental policy acts, our own clean water laws. Northern Cheyenne was the first tribe in the country to petition for Class 1 air quality under the Federal Clean Air Act. So we're engaged in asserting our rights as governments. You know, we have tribal constitutions. We recently revised our constitution. We have tribal courts that are very active on the reservation and enforcing our laws. We're very much like a sovereign government within the United States. And because of that, we are very politically engaged, whether it's your state government, whether it's your federal government, because we are creatures of political law. And we have to be engaged in order to protect our sovereign status. So we get involved, like for example, we've done federal Indian Voting Rights Act lawsuits. People may think that, you know, we just do environmental law, but no, we're engaged in multi-issue work because you're building a movement. So we've been involved in Montana, and we actually set the precedent for Indian Voting Rights Act, where we're now, we've got a lot of Indians in policy positions in the state of Montana for the first time ever, because we deal with a lot of racism. You know, the racial polarization is very heavy in Montana and in this whole Northern Plains area, and it really hinders our movement as a group of people who are all tied to the land. So we're involved in a lot of racial, I always call it racial justice challenges. Like, for example, right now we're involved in the Otter Creek coal mine. This is going to be the biggest coal mine in the United States. It is even bigger than what we're facing right now, a coal strip. So we're surrounded by massive energy development. You know, in the United States, people think we're all moving toward green energy, alternative energy. But we are in the process right now under this administration of permitting the largest coal strip mine in the United States. Included in that is a new railroad, the Tongue River Railroad. And this is all huge development that's occurring right now. And it's only about 5 miles from my reservation. So we're becoming an island, being surrounded by massive energy development. And I always say we're very much like a sacrifice area, very much like that. You know, there's a big move up here to protect the northern reaches here of the Flathead River and the Blackfoot River. You know, it's like pristine area over here on the west of Montana. But eastern Montana is almost becoming a sacrifice zone. And I think a lot of that goes back to, you know, political power, but also because there's very few people that live there except Indians. You know, us and the Crow tribe, you know, we're 2 million acres of land between our two reservations. We're pretty much southeastern Montana. You have some non-Indians that are living there, but they're primarily ranching families, and fewer of them are staying there. They're leaving, their kids are leaving. So when we did our reapportionment of Montana, we had to actually merge all those non-Indian areas into a single district because they've lost so much population. So what you're finding is the people who are remaining there in this area that is quickly becoming a sacrifice zone to the energy companies, really are the Indian tribes. But we're growing too. Our people are growing. We're a very young tribe. So the crisis that we're having, I think, you know, you have to look at it in terms of what can be done on a small scale as well as a broad global level, particularly when you're looking at climate justice issues. You know, there's a movement afoot right now that is really in the research stages of using the public trust doctrine. This is a real interesting issue that journalists should really jump on. There's a whole field of law that is common law, but it's called the public trust doctrine, and it's basically protect your interests as well as mine and in the future. So for example, public lands belong to all of us, right? It's similar when you look at climate justice. The air belongs to all of us, and it's something that you can't fragment by countries, so it's a global effort. So there's a group of international environmental justice lawyers taking a look at climate change and really trying to move it into the judicial arena to fill the gap from both states and national governments in addressing this issue of climate change. So I think it's something that I'm giving you a heads up on to keep that in mind. There's a strategy now to look at what are some key cases around the world that could bring this type of public trust law into the global climate change arena. And the other issue I think that is I want to throw out there is the need to really begin looking at keeping coal in the ground. How do you keep coal in the ground and provide some compensation to those landowners, say the big Indian tribes like Cheyenne and Crow? If you could compensate them for the coal in the ground to keep it there, that would help with poverty. The huge poverty levels that we're facing right now and getting even hit harder right now, as well as keeping the protection of these lands that are very sacred to the indigenous peoples of this area. And I think there's analogies to look at that. You look at the payment in lieu of taxes, if you, any of you have ever followed that with the rangelands, where you keep rangelands from being used or being farmed, and so farmers and ranchers will get payment in lieu of taxes. There's also a big analogy, I think, with tax credits, where large corporations get tax credits for, building, Section 8 housing. There's all those type of analogies to keep coal in the ground and make that payment. But then again, that's going to take congressional legislation. But see, we have to be creative, folks. We have to understand that these issues that are before us are very, they're moving fast. You know, we don't have a whole lot of time to sit around here and think, what are we going to do about climate justice? You know, I mean, it's already happening. You know, in our area, I was telling Jody, with the Elkherds, you know, with all the COVID methane gas development and the coal mining and the climate change, you know, we have elk going through our reservation that were never in these certain areas of land. There are migratory patterns that are all disrupted. Like the Indian hunters, my nephew was just saying that, you know, I think the elk are getting lost. He said, what's happening is all these COVID methane thumpers, they're shaking the land and vibrating so hard that our elk are afraid now to cross the river and go into the forest where they've always gone. So, you know, there's tremendous impact now that's already occurring, also with the sage grouse, you know, that are becoming endangered because of their habitat loss. And the sage grouse are very sacred to us. You know, this is where, you know, our people do a dance. It's called the chicken dance. It's a beautiful dance. And we mimic these sage grouse. So we're tied to this land in all aspects. So, you know, we need to be creative in thinking about how we're going to maintain what we have and not become the sacrifice zone that is occurring. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. I want to just let everybody know that she has a website, nativeaction.org. You can get a lot more information about her organization. Nativeaction.org.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to this panel. I think you'll find it's the most complicated subject that you'll find at the SCJ conference. And just to go off what Gail was saying, if you want to see the new energy fight in the United States, the Powder River Basin is where it's at. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I have to point out that in the 1970s, there was a North Central Power Study that the federal government put out. They actually referred to the Powder River Basin as the National Sacrifice Area. They used those exact terms. They proposed over 30 coal-fired power plants and basically wanted to strip mine the whole basin. So the fact that we have that kind of history there, and everyone talks about the move to renewables, but really what's happening in the basin is leasing of coal, new proposed coal mines, Otter Creek Coal, they're going for it, and the Powder River Basin is where 40% of the nation's coal comes from, and as mountaintop removal decreases, Powder River Basin coal will become the new, not it is right now, but it will become even more industrialized, and it's a beautiful part of the country that I think people don't think of. You know, people come to Western Montana, but the beauty in Eastern Montana is unparalleled. So anyway, I am from Billings, Montana. I have a fourth generation Montanan, and I'm also a rancher. I've worked in tribal lands conservation issues for over a decade, and I think any story that you do on energy or climate is a tribal story. You can't separate the two. The people who are feeling the worst effects of climate change are tribes. And the people who had no impact on climate. So we're having the worst effects on tribal lands, but it's on people who had no say in what was happening with energy policy. So in a few caveats that I have to make is I'm not speaking for a tribe. I'm speaking out of my own experience. I'm not a tribal member. And so anything I say is based on work with the National Wildlife Federation. Second is, what we find is people tend to make generalizations about tribes, and there are over 535 tribal governments, sovereign nations, completely different treaties, regulations, laws, constitutions, and so if people make generalizations, they're all usually false. So if I make any, just disregard them. So I'm going to go really briefly over the history of energy development on tribal lands. And so there was themes that happened for the past two centuries. And one is basically massive federal failure of oversight of energy development on tribal lands for decades. Leases negotiated on behalf of tribes by federal agencies were inadequate, corrupt. There was minerals stolen off tribal lands. You know, that's part of the Cobell case, if you've been following that. So there's a huge history of just complete corruption and incompetency in terms of the federal government's oversight of leasing on tribal lands. I think we're moving into a new era due to new laws and regulations that I won't get into now, where there's increasing sovereignty. And what Gail was talking about, that there's an opportunity for tribes right now to take control over their natural resources and really decide what they want to do with them, not what someone else decides they should do with them. Another problem was basically contradictory federal policy. So you'd have some laws that said one thing, other laws that said other things, and energy companies took advantage of that. And then you ended up with things where energy companies might go in, mine uranium, and then leave a Superfund site for the tribe to clean up. That was common. That is common. right now. And then basically a complete lack of cultural and historic preservation. So a lot of times the cultural sites weren't taken into consideration. Mining happened, and that was tribal input in terms of what was going on was just not taken into consideration. So an interesting thing happened, though, is when reservations were created, the land that they picked for reservations was, they thought it was the most marginal land because they were looking at agricultural land. And so in reality, what you have is right now, if you overlay maps of not only mineral, you know, coal, oil, gas, but wind, solar, geothermal. And if you look in our report, we have, it's called New Energy Future in Indian Country. Those maps are in there. And you can see that the best wind resources, the best solar resources, best geothermal, best biomass sources are on tribal lands. And actually in coal too. You look at the coal resources in the U.S. and tribal lands overlay that. And so right now there is an energy rush and tribes are in the crosshairs of that. A lot of companies will exploit the economic situation that tribes face with the promise of wealth. Never comes to bear. You know, you never see a situation where that actually happens. It's just the promise of that. So what National Wildlife Federation Tribal Lands Program does is we work with tribes who are interested in working with us on alternative solutions to developing mineral resources, such as small-scale wind energy efficiency, any help with policy, lobbying for better laws for tribes. We kind of run the gamut on what tribes want to do, and that's what we work all over the country in the West. And from climate change to wildlife issues and environmental education. And I think, you know, there's a huge opportunity right now for tribes to have economic development through renewable energy and not necessarily large scale. I think people focus way too much on the large scale, which is one of those things that you can set yourself up for failure pretty easily if you want the large megawatt solar facilities or wind facilities. And so we work a lot to put small scale renewable up, train people in how to build these solar air heaters and really focus on small scale projects that can succeed right away. So if, you know, generally speaking, I think this subject, to really understand energy development in Indian country, you need to look at the history, the two centuries of the regulations, the laws, to see how complicated it actually is right now. And people think, I think people assume that just because tribes are sovereign that you can do whatever you want and that it's just easy because you don't have to follow federal regulations, but that's not true. I mean, we have companies who think that they can go on and start a coal mine very quickly because they assume that the tribe can go around, you know, like National Environmental Policy Act. And so I think my advice to you is if you're covering anything that has to do with energy development in Indian country, it's really complicated. And take the time to learn the history of the tribe. Take the time to learn the history of the laws and regulations, and you might get a better picture of what's actually happening. So thank you.
Thanks, Alexis. That's good. You're giving a rundown in the background of some complicated issues with energy development on tribal lands there and from a legal and environmental perspective. My name is Pat Spears. I'm a member of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, which is surrounded by South Dakota. It's on the Missouri River, downriver from Fort Pierre. I live about halfway between Lower Brule Tribal headquarters in Fort Pierre. So, my story here has a lot to do with the river. So, why I'm opening with that, because intertribal coup or council on utility policy represents 15 tribes that are separate and distinct governments, and in the Northern Plains, it's primarily in the Dakotas. The Northern Arapahoes are members. the Omahas are members also. We've spoken with a number of Montana tribes who may become members in the future. If it's to their benefit right now, we just share information with those who ask, and we've got enough to handle over on the plains east of us here with energy development in the wind. I know there's some very serious issues going on with coal development over here that Gail pointed out, and you know, we have to admire the Northern Cheyenne for being the first tribe to get clean, the Class 1 clean air status and refuse to develop coal, and then the coal bed methane's there because of the obvious pollution to the air, water, and such. I mean, the Lakotas have a stake in the Powder River Basin too, because under our 1868 treaty, that's our western boundary. But that's part of some of the losses that come when you take on a wild general there that was intent on killing families and such there, and made an example of him. So after that, there was a retaliation against the Lakotas, Northern Arapaho, and the Cheyenne, who were allies in that fight. And we hope to be again in protecting our mother and grandmother. What she was talking about is leaving coal in the ground makes much sense, because the coal that lays underneath the northern plains are filters for water. If you look at it, like some of our spiritual leaders have pointed out, that those are the organs of our grandmother. That's the liver and the kidneys. And they've become sick, ailing now. We have respiratory problems, heart problems, because the rivers are dammed up. So when you look at her health now, grandmother's sick, we need to help heal her, or she's going to heal herself one way or another through a purification. And it's up to us if we're going to live through that and survive in the way we're supposed to live here or not. I mean, I look at it that seriously, because we're the sway vote in this climate discussion, what's going on now. This last 100 years, mostly the last 50, have destroyed a good bit of creation and fouled it tremendously. So that's what the call is amongst our people, is to heal. We've got to heal ourselves, because it's reflected in our human health also there when you look at it from that perspective. So our big issue is the damming of the rivers. There are 6 dams on the Missouri River starting up here in Montana and ending up down in the Yankton Reservation and in what's now Yankton, South Dakota, too there. So they plugged it up through the 50s, and the last one was in 1963. It joined the Lower Brule Reservation and the Crow Creek Reservation. They were across the river from us. And we're still in economic, cultural, social, spiritual recovery from that, because it took our best lands, our best habitat for animals had to move, people had to move, even our cemeteries had to be moved. Some of them didn't have enough time. So when the river's so low now, some of our ancestors' remains come up at White Swan on the Yankton Reds and up on Standing Rock Reservation in Wapa. Those are people's living relatives still laying out there, that they knew them, and so that's it's pretty hard. It's a pretty emotional issue to take. And we've watched the Missouri River go down over the last 25 years. We've broken the record for the all-time low twice in the last 6-7 years. And, we have the hottest Julys on record that keeps going up and up because of global warming. So we made the case that this is the flooding of the Missouri River is an environmental justice issue. Brian Deloria, one of our respected Lakota scholars, he likened the flooding of the Missouri River as the second single hardest blow to the Missouri Basin people as the killing of the buffalo. And you think about that, the buffalo, what they meant to us is food, shelter, and relatives and medicine, and they know that too, and they still know that because of our close relationship through our ceremonies. And when we lived along the river, that's a place of sustenance and a place where you had everything, food, water, fuel, medicine, and you know, the animals that are there also. It's it, it took away that we had communities along the river then where people could live and survive much as we used to. And you know, a depression came and went on the reservations without much effect. In fact, white people came to Indian people and asked, "How do you live through this? How do you survive?" And our people took people in that were neighbors. Others were wanderers. Everyone has stories about someone who came through, an old man, an old sailor, an old cowboy, like that, that were taken in by families. So my family grew up along that river. My mother was the last one born out there in what's called the Fort George District. Fort George only lasted a couple of years, really, because Grandpa and them, they ran them off, and they went to Fort Pierre and actually took down boards and posts of that fort and built up Fort Pierre. That was like 1825. So that's where my family is raised, right around that area. And we're living back there again. So this issue of the river has it's a sore spot amongst us, but it also did something else that can be a benefit. They built a transmission system to carry hydropower to every community across the Dakotas and in the whole northern plains and provide cheap, low-cost power to those communities. Everybody but the Indian communities. So I learned about this as a planner for my tribe and helped develop irrigation along the river. I found out where this WAPA power that's sold, transmitted by the Western Power Administration, where it goes, who gets the benefits of this. We sure didn't. You want to know where the dams are located? Take a look where the reservations are. You know, and you look where the major communities are. They're right above them, so they didn't get flooded. They have a little bit of nice timberland left, but we all used to enjoy. So they transmitted the power to all these communities at incredibly low prices, like 6 mils was what it started out at for communities. 2.5 mils for pumping power for irrigation, 6 mils. You know, mils a tenth of a cent. And so these were all built with federal money. None of them made sense economically. None of them passed a good cost-benefit ratio analysis. They all lose money, and they've been deferring the repayments of them for years. Congress just keeps pushing that back. And the true cost of them has never really come out. There's been some efforts to restore some of the promises and some money come back to restore some of those lands again and some of the infrastructure, but still not enough. So we want to make use of the transmission system that's there. And it's been taken over by coal power. 80-85% in the Upper Great Plains region of the power on there is coal power. At times when the river is so low that there's not enough water to turn the turbines, so they have to buy supplemental power to meet 20-year hydropower contracts to all these customers across the Northern Plains and elsewhere in the West. And we say, what's wrong with that picture when we have the wind blowing by at 18 miles an hour? Averages on the reservation and 40% capacity, 45% of the time. If you get up higher, it's even more. So it's foolish, we think, both environmentally to keep, you know, adding coal power and putting more CO2 in the SOx, NOx, and the mercury that spreads and blows to the west in the what's now we call a windshed. You know. We all learn what watersheds are, where pollution goes. Well, the same thing happens with the wind. That pollution scattered across the country and it blows to your neighbors, and a couple days later it's on the East Coast. So you're well aware as environmental writers, you know, about the effects of those chemicals that are there. CO2 is now considered a pollutant. I'm glad that the courts have recognized that. It's going to have to get turned into a public policy now and valued so that we don't build any more coal plants. I mean, there's some of them are stopping. To the east of us are going down. Big Stone 2 in South Dakota is not going to happen for economic reasons primarily. Cost too much to build them. One in Selby, South Dakota, not. They proposed one by Fort Pierre. 3 in North Dakota, there's one of them still might happen there. But over here in Montana, they got 5 or 6 of them still on the books, I think, in both states each. Serious problems in feeding the monster. And so we want to use the transmission system to put wind on it. Restore it to be a collector of renewable energy, as hydropower once was. You know, it's a diminishing resource, so we want to make use of it, and we want to do it as intertribal an intertribal alliance we have to develop a community wind for our communities, because if you do this larger, it makes it cheaper for community wind. It's really hard to fund small projects and single turbine projects, because it's all designed for the big companies, big tax credits, which we can't use. So we've introduced legislation that tribes can share the production tax credit, and we've gotten it through the Senate before. It's up again, and it's a tough battle to do this without the policy work. So we're looking at this alliance. One by one, big companies can come in, make promises. You're going to have, you know, hundreds of megawatts, and we do have 200 gigawatts of potential in tribal land. That's a fourth of the energy capacity in this country. We don't want wall-to-wall turbines either. We want enough to restore our economies so that we can live again as we should. So that's what our alliance is about, and we also want to take advantage of an executive order that the president put out a year ago in October that says we're going to green all the federal agencies. And that order, I think it's 13514, says develop a plan and how to measure your carbon footprint, and I want to know what you're going to do about it. And OMB is going to monitor it. That's unprecedented, to have OMB doing something like that. I think they ought to. So good things are happening in the Obama administration. Much pressure on from the coal boys and the fossil fuel boys here. We're going to see what's going to happen here. But we can't sit still and not move forward on it. And you're going to help us get that word out here, because you're part of the ally camp, in my opinion. And, you know, warriors and people who speak up and believe in the earth. And Indians are a big part of that, part of the earth, the scale setting.
Okay, and Pat,
we need your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. And our members have a chance to ask you some questions. I think Pat's presentation, I know the work that he's doing, and Alexis was right in describing, when you talk about Native issues, you have a whole history to consider, and then all of the legal complications that come with that. Pat did not really get to talk about the WAPA, the Western Area Power Administration, hydropower and wind feasibility study that they just released back in August. Pat has some comments that he wrote in response to that particular study, and what it was trying to, what the feasibility study did was look at how much tribes, those 15 tribes that are part of the intertribal coup, how much could they contribute to the get onto the energy grid, and it was actually very disappointing for what tribes can contribute for wind power. And when that feasibility study came back, they were looking at 50 megawatts that they thought tribes that they might have room for, which is only a very small fraction of the wind that tribes would be able to contribute. Point is, his comments were very insightful, and it's going to give you a lot of background information on what's at stake here for tribes and how they're being left out of the renewable energy equation. I have his documents linked to my website, which is buffalosfire.com. I just posted made a blog posting last night. If you go on there, you'll get the link to his comments. And there's also a link to the WAPA feasibility study. So we're going to move on to Rob McDonald, who will help shed some light onto when you're going into tribal lands and you're dealing with these issues, how do you best go about that? So I'll let him take over from here. Thanks, Rob.
Good morning. Yes, Quex. Quex is Chen. How are you? I feel like my 8-year-old son listening to these three talk, because every issue they touch upon, I don't want to jump in, be real cultish, go, oh, B2, well, that's happening on Earth. That's a huge issue. We have this. So you're getting great information, great access. And by show of hands real quick, how many are journalists for magazines, newspapers, publications? So you're charged with trying to capture some of this information and put it to a story form. You're looking at three great individuals to help get you the context and identify these stories that you can dust off, isolate, and then present to the general public. And I see in these three freedom working for the institutions that they work from, because they're a standalone institution, not under the umbrella of a tribal government. But there's a confusion that kind of comes up that I hear a lot about Indian country, and this is just I might state some obvious things here, but I'll go through them. When I was an intern at the Seattle Times, I remember I was trying to be smug and all smart as I was being interviewed by the editor, city edit manager, Mike Wynn, a small, balding Irish guy. He said, you covered city governments? Oh, yeah, I'm pretty versed. Well, do you think the city council should adopt the strong mayor proposal, or should they go to the weak mayor? Do you think the power council commissioner should? And I just looked at him blank. He said, you don't know the structure of the government. No, you don't know how it works. You don't know the moving pieces. Go find out. And then we'll see about you covering that. Yet I see very high-skilled journalists and their bosses not having an understanding of how much they don't know about how a tribal government works. And it is to your detriment that you don't know these things, because there are many landmines you will step on potentially, and any one landmine will set you back three steps, if not damage your ability to get a story done. How do you learn this? I was just thinking about that. How, you know, it's not in textbooks. You're not taught in high school, grade school. There's college classes that don't really address what the modern governmental structure of any specific tribe, because there's 650 plus registered, you know, recognized tribes in the country. State recognized tribes, not federally recognized. We're all complicated. Different parts of the world, different histories. You know, treaties made with Congress, treaties made by you know, Governor Stevens for us, for instance. And I could go on and on about the complexity, but just know when you step in Indian country, it is incredibly complex. You're dealing with a federal-Indian relationship. And the ignorance is rampant. The NCAI just did studies a couple of years ago, that's the National Congress of American Indians, that flat out states people know next to nil about Indian country, and it hampers their understanding of anything we try to promote. They did some press public relations campaigns, and it was did not go very well, the message. They thought, well, it must be too confusing. They did some studies. Studies show that people understood it very clearly. They just rejected it out of hand. They were asked, why did you not accept this message? Well, it didn't match up to what I already heard or believed, so I just ignored it. Cognitive dissonance was the phrase they used. Don't tell me something I already know. But what most of America knows about Indian country is just flat out wrong and shaped by incorrect information, misinformation, going back to Lewis and Clark when they had the, you know, Lewis and Clark journals sold pretty well, but people found out if they made fake journals, you know, with Indian princesses with stretched out necks with rings and these exotic tribal people, you know, they'd sell very well, and that kind of became the body of work that became the Hollywood Indian incorrect. You know, just we're inundated with that, us too, and people don't know what to think. Some basic points. How many of you, just by show of hands, have tried to call an Indian government and did not get calls back the way you thought you should? Ah, the people of the phone meet the people not of the phone. We're a tight-knit group. We know who we know. We know who we need to know. And on the spectrum of taking care of our people, our elders, our youth, our safety nets, our political fights, our battles, responding to some media person is probably just going to burn us anyway, is not really high on the priority list of most tribes. The history of journalism in Indian country isn't quite the same as it is in the mainstream. And in fact, the understanding of how journalism works in Indian country, I found, is vastly different than the way the mainstream understands it. Jody Rave and myself are two, I'm an enrolled member of the Sage Kootenai tribes, worked in mainstream media 15 years. We probably knew mainstream journalists, we could count on two hands, maybe three. They just aren't that many, and are less now with the layoffs. And as our colleagues were getting better pay around the country, they were, you know, like other higher paid journalists, kind of targeted to, you know, hey, we should get you out of here, bring in some young interns. And, you know, the world of journalism has gone through an evolution where it's been too expensive to keep on highly trained journalists. But I'm hoping for a revival of public relations in Indian country, because that is a movement I've seen. Kara Briggs, another journalist, formerly of the Portland Oregonian, helped edit a book pushing the idea that Indian country needs to invest as much into public relations and essentially telling our story and getting it out there the right way as much as we put into law firms and legal issues and whatnot. So much to say, so little time. I work internally very hard with my tribe. 4 years ago, they asked me to be the communications director. I was the second person to do that. Well, actually, one of my cousins, who was enrolled in a different tribe, tried it for a year and ended up going to Helena and lobbying with some relatives and getting very plugged in and kind of went off to start her own business. She left, opening came up. Newspapers weren't the same, and I looked for something new to invest my passion into. And what I encountered was pretty stark at first, is that none of the newspapers knew who to call. None of the media knew how to call for comment. They had developed these sources, which I would consider not our best agents to represent us. People most inclined to talk to media were those who were probably disgruntled employees of the tribes, those who felt they may have been gotten a very raw deal 20 years in the past, 10 years in the past from council that may not be as sophisticated as they are today, and made an effort to talk about how corrupt, how awful, how horrible things are. Not our best agent, not our best foot forward, and this is our ambassadors out there setting the mindset further into the media. And I also noticed a tendency that we were kind of like the Amish in a way, in that other federal agencies, state agencies, were very accustomed to knowing. Now, I can't say they knew it on purpose, but it just kind of worked this way, that if you can maneuver this reporter out of my office and kind of direct them toward the tribes, yes, we have this policy, yes, we enacted it, but it was through dealings with the tribes that we developed this philosophy. She will talk to them as to the particulars of why we protect the forest land this way. I know we'd love for you ladies in white who want to start a business taking ashes of dead people and putting them out in the woods, and we turned down the proposal, but it wasn't us, it was really our negotiations with the tribes, and it's really their preference, so go talk to them. And most times for, I think, 50 years, the media has not always been the friend of Indian country. And I think we did the very Indian thing. We turned our backs. We quit talking to them. In doing this, and this is what I say daily to our council members and other people in our government, we allow our political opponents to have their full say about us, and they fill in the gaps. I still have communities around me, particularly in Kalispell, who don't bother calling us. What is your take on hydrothermal energy? What's your take on this development? What do you think of this company? They kind of, I don't know where they come up with their answers, but they seem to know pretty clearly where we stand and tell me to my face, here's where the tribes stand. And I just flat out say, you're completely wrong. I'm not sure where you got your information, but our council just passed this action. This is how we stand, and this is where we feel. And they'll look at me and go, well, that's not what we heard. I'm telling you from the source, from the mouth of the river, and they are rejecting it. I don't know what to do about that. The good news is, in talking about humanity and the evolution of acceptance and getting us at to the table, is that I've had great luck most other places, and I'm a fan of the Flathead Beacon, Connie Chung, Maury Povich, thank you. They're kind of bringing a new voice of solid journalism to the community. This is kind of a slanted political taint to a lot of the coverage up there, unfortunately, including the bull trout coverage, which is just maybe maddening what they will put in the print at times. The ignorance is so deep. We have a water rights negotiations issue. You know about that. All the land is reserved for our exclusive use, 1855. For future decisions, all the water is reserved for our exclusive use. Supreme Court starts chewing on that and making it a little smaller. Basically, we're at the point now where they say, well, you got to deal with the state as the state implements federal law into how this water is broken up on reservations. And this is all federal land, military bases, forestry land. The state did with it with a very unique way. I won't get too deep into the Compact Water Commission, but we are the last reservation left to form a water negotiation with the state on how all the water is managed and ruled. There's a long history here. There's tons of lawsuits between non-tribal organizations thinking they have control of the water. They've lost every one to us. And we've made great strides, formed partnerships, and people who couldn't be in the same room 10 years ago are now partners and on the same board working things out in our reservation. Part of this is because we're outnumbered 5-1 on our own reservation due to homesteading, allotment, checkerboarding. I'm going really fast, so this is a hint of the complexity you're dealing with. You got to know the specific reservation you're dealing with, and you got to know who you're talking to. And one of the main points is, who are you talking to? There's this effort to stop the haul, the energy, the oil companies, tar sands, they want to widen the roads. And the roads are going through Indian country. The Nez Perce have always been very vocal, very active, and very supportive of speaking out. They just appeared in the LA Times. The New York Times just called the Missoula County Commissioner to get comment about all this. We put out a letter to the State Department of Transportation explaining how we have sensitive sites that could be impacted by widening of the road, and we want, you know, a full, careful process if they do anything. We're also going to be on the amicus brief, but we haven't signed on that yet on this. But they're going through the Blackfeet. So I hear a lot of traffic from this group calling me. Do you know where the Blackfeet Council stands on this? No, I don't. Do you know anybody who does? Well, you're talking to their head attorney. That's the best position person. Well, they don't know. Well, maybe they should go find out. Or council is still debating and talking amongst themselves how they feel, the stance they want to take. Well, we heard Eloise Cobell has a strong point of view on this. Well, she very well may be, but she's not part of the governmental structure. She's an individual that's very high profile and in the media, but she doesn't speak for the people. Now, if you get to her, which I think won't happen, and if she says, yes, I feel very strongly about this and I want to use my words, she could do that. However, the council will be sitting there going, wait a minute, why is this individual, no matter how high profile she is, why is she speaking for our government? That, you know, that will not settle well with the government. And God help the reporter who puts that out there, you know, because if you try to approach council, like, oh, you're the one that, you know, got it all messed up and confused. That's a high-profile example. What happens most often is you get access to an attorney, an engineer, a policy expert within the tribes who reveals some of these things. And then as a reporter, you show up going, I want to talk to you about some of these things. And that person will suddenly go, oh, it just got real serious. Essentially, if you write and quote me, you're going to get my head lopped off because I do not have the authority to reveal this to you for an article for print and publication. So then the journalist says, oh, okay, well, better call counsel. They'll call counsel. It'll go to probably, you know, if there's no person like me, and I'm a rare position in Indian country, I do live for the day when there's more people like me handling the media calls, screening them, getting a sense for what they want, and then feeding it to, saying this is a very repeated reporter, we dealt with them 4 times in the past, they're very skillful, we should trust them, and great, let's do that. Instead, you're all kind of lumped in the category of, oh, this is somebody that just takes what we say and just kind of burn us. And no matter what we say, it comes around and bites us, so let's just ignore them, you know, because what's the worst thing they can do? Write some bad stuff about us? Well, they've been doing that for 50 years. Why should they stop doing that now? quick anecdote. My 6 months into the job, reporter calls, Vince Devlin, lives in Polson, from the Missoulian, former sports writer, has a quiet way about him, but is very good in not getting fooled into writing the crackpot negative stuff against the tribes, but he will thump us legitimately if we deserve it. All we ask is fair and square. He gives it to us, has proven himself. Calls me up and says, Rob, we're doing a series on forestry management. We've never done a story on how the tribes manage their vast forest lands. We took it over from the BIA when the BIA would overforest our lands, and now we manage it in a much more culturally sensitive, appropriate way of set asides. Let me go talk to the chairman. I can't speak to you unless I get clearance from the chairman, who gets clearance from the council, and council gets clearance from the people. Talk to the chairman, explain everything. He says, I recommend we go forward. I think this is a great opportunity to just unfettered view on how we manage ourselves, because that's not known. We know it. Our peers know it. People we work with know it. The general public doesn't. I get the clearance. I go to the department head, Jim Durglow, and I go, Jim, we're okay to do this. And he looks at me and says, I don't want to do this. Why don't you want to do this? Well, if we do this, then it's just going to come back and bite us. They're going to burn us. They always do it every time you say anything. Put anything out there, it's going to turn around, and they're going to, you know, there's going to be some in there like me that just kind of zings us. I say, it's my neck. I'm the one that said we should do this. I'm banking my reputation, possibly my, you know, future job prospects here. staying on, you know, if I'm wrong, and I'm banking everything on this. So he does the interview. I listen in, I don't say anything. It's a 45-minute interview, very detailed, very matter-of-fact, and then the reporter hangs up, and I'm there talking to the Jim Durkle, and he goes, well, we'll see how that's going to come back and bite us. You know, it's still, you know, just waiting for the hammer to fall. And the story comes out, and it's amazing. Actually, an attorney tied with the Blackfeet, Pat Smith, called me up and said, this is incredible. How did this happen? How did this story? I've never seen this kind of access, accuracy, depth, and depiction of the tribes, you know, and all the great things you do get put out there. I said, we simply said yes. But we said yes the right time, to the right person, to the right publication, to the right tone, this and that. And best I can offer is, if you have friends in Indian country, lean on them, ask them, what's the best way to approach? Who should I get to? Don't call, show up if you can. Don't call and expect a call back if we don't know you already. Meet the people and get in front of them. We're face-to-face people. You know, it takes a little work to get into our company and know.
Okay, very well said. And we're going to move into a question and answer period. So do we have anybody in the audience that would have a question for Gail, Alexis, Rob, or Pat?
Yeah, Jim Rogers. I used to live in Montana a long time ago, and I'm a little out of date on my Montana Indian Reservation energy policies. But my understanding is there's some tribal governments that actually have supported oil and gas development and coal development. Could you go over which ones do and why they might do that?
I can talk about a small portion of that. I think a lot of that may apply to the tribes east of us. But speaking for my tribe very quickly, and I'll turn it over, is we just don't have those resources.
Rob, can you actually, I don't know if everybody heard, and I don't think I did, can you repeat the question?
Could you repeat it for me, Zach?
I was wondering which tribal governments in Montana actually support energy, coal and oil and gas development, and why they might do that? Because I'm getting the sense that I'm just trying to understand what the range of perspectives of energy development is in Indian country in this state.
Without knowing the answer, I'll just say it's completely across the board, it's completely diverse, and there's a complete different set of reasons for each decision. There's no way to lump it together easily, except we're a complex community of many different needs.
Okay, and the question again is, what tribes in Montana are supportive of natural resource extraction? We're mainly looking here in Montana at coal and oil development. Gail can answer this question because she deals with many of these issues over on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation.
And I think it varies depending on the folks that are elected in office. I don't think you can just say what tribes support this and what tribes don't, because I think it's like a generalization. Every tribe is very distinct, and the issues in that tribe are very different. And we go through elections just like the state government does, the federal government does, and those priorities and those policies shift as well. So I don't think you can really say that one tribe is, you know, gung-ho on energy development. I think if you look at the issues that are before tribes, I think you've got some major water issues before tribes, like on water rights, like you're hearing up here with the Salish and Kootenai tribes. Crow are the same way. They're involved in trying to get a big water settlement right now. And oftentimes those issues are kind of tied into energy development. I know there's a big energy proposal pending before the Crow that is very dependent on them getting their water rights quantified. So they're tied together, so it's very complex. And then you've got a lot of issues up on the Fort Peck where they've been involved in oil and gas for a number of years already. So, you know, I think it's, you can't, like, I couldn't say, for example, that, you know, this tribe's for that, this tribe's against that, because I think it's in flux. And it's dependent on, like, just everyone else, like, in the country. You know, you're involved in elections, and those priorities change, and a lot of it depends on who gets elected.
Okay, question?
Yeah, I'm Tali Nam, I'm with the Native Sun News in Rapid City, South Dakota. I think there's a story that we could take away from here today. It's the positive renewable energy activities that are being gathered together through the intertribal COOP. And I think it would be great to hear a little bit more about what's happening today with that effort, if Pat would oblige us.
Okay. Pat's being asked if he would talk more about the renewable energy efforts of Intertribal COOP.
Sure, I'm glad to. I kind of told a lot of stories, you can tell. I like to tell stories. Gail's got me in that mode when she says, and, so excuse me for a bit of that, but some of the specific things that we are doing, COO has a five-phase plan for wind development, beginning with, community wind. We did the Rosebud Wind Turbine, which was the first one at commercial scale in Indian Country. Keeley Radio Station, we're replacing that turbine in there. Fort Berthold has another 65 kW turbine there. We have calls for those in other communities there. So we're working both at that level and also a dedicated part of our larger project plans to community wind because of the economy to scale, and just because it's cheaper to get turbines in. Our project is a 450 megawatt project. We got 9 reservations there, 50 megawatt sites, and we've done the feasibility on them. We have gotten them to the development stage of where we need interconnection studies and the overall environmental assessment. We've done the initial work there. But this is a large regional distributed energy concept. You're a distributed generation being a group of, let's say, in the communities, farms, ranches, smaller projects, and meeting your needs that way. Well, that concept can apply also on a regional scale and feeding into the WAPA system, not choking the horse so much at any one spot with 300 megawatts, 500 here and there, which could be done. The system will not allow that. There's not enough capacity there. So we're coming in slower. Smaller amounts we think can fit in there. And the feasibility study that Jody was referencing is something we wrote into the Energy Act of 2005, Section 2606. You can go to WAPA's website, WAPA.gov, and find that. That's something that came from COO, just about verbatim, that's in the law. When they did the study, they didn't go all the way. They did half the job and came up with 50 megawatts as what's available for tribes there. Well, that's because they have 300 under negotiation with non-tribal projects. Half of that's going in, we hear maybe not the other half. And they're 5-year contracts. So one thing we can do is get ready to meet those contracts the next go-around at these sites, and we're preparing to do that. There's two, in my opinion, there's two capacity issues here. There's contract capacity, which someone has bought up space on the line and uses for X number of megawatt, and there's actual physical and electron capacity. So you need engineers to help you figure that out. There's been two studies done, one by Stanford, one by Carnegie Mellon, that says wind and hydropower can be integrated in a bigger way, and you can feed wind into the system all the time, and then add water from hydropower. Then add coal as the last resort. And we want WAPA to change its paradigm of operating. And we want to study that. We want to demonstrate it, actually. So we've engaged two different groups here. One is an engineering group out of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the Wind Technology Center in Boulder. Guys that have been wanting to do this, get deeper into the WAPA and Corps of Engineers generation work. So they've done part of that. And they can only go so far because they're not customers, they're not tribes. We are customers of WAPA, but different because we are tribal governments and we have a treaty relationship, there's public law relationship, there's lots of the complex legal issues here that was alluded to that you can research. So that's our strength. We want to make use of that. So we've engaged the University Center for Atmospheric Research to develop some climate models looking at precipitation in the next 20, 30 years in the whole Missouri Basin, and how that's going to impact energy production, hydropower.
both prophecy and science tell us that we're headed into some big drought times. And the geologists have studied the Earth and determined over the last few thousand years, we go through these 150, 170 year wet and dry cycles. We're about the 170th year of the last wet cycle. So it's a hold on, it's coming. And that's coming from both, you know, from tribal people who have a unique perspective and insight because of our culture and our spirituality, and scientists and global science. So these are the guys at UCAR that do the USGCRP studies and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Those models are going to be helpful in predicting what WAPA's going to do. So we've encouraged WAPA to do their own integrated resource plan, and they require everybody that gets a hydropower allocation to do one. Look at your other sources of energy and use it in planning for your community. And so we said, well, let's take a look at wind. So we have a new administrator there. He's been there 2 years now, who we have some agreement with. His three priorities, which he put in print, by the way, and I'll get you copies of this also. But they are wind energy, transmission upgrades, and partnerships with tribes. We helped get those into public law, and that's why he's quoting them. And he, I believe, is sincere about this, but he has to do two things. Provide low-cost power, reliable power at their customers' request. So we're going to cities, irrigation districts, public power districts, and asking them to be allies also to buy tribal wind, blend it into the system and stop buying fossil fuel and fueling that process, and restore this grid to be a collector of renewable energy. So that's part of what we're up to in the large groundswell. We've got some other people in South Dakota, North Dakota, some environmental organizations, rural organizations that are allying with us. So we're trying to build new cowboys and Indians, farmers and Indians alliances, and communities, of course.
Okay, I'm going to pay attention here.
Jody, I'm sorry. Could I just say one thing? Because I just want to draw everybody's attention to the report that's back there. Again, Intertribal Coup is a partner on that report, and Pat's quoted in it. So please do help yourself to copies of it at the back.
Intertribalcoup.org is a good source. Go to nativeenergy.org also. I haven't said much about it, but Native Energy buys the RECs, the green tags, the carbon offsets, and provides the builder or owner of the project with a check to help you build it, to help build program and help you finance it. And for community wind, it's just essential. We use that through the Rosewood Project, Keeley, and we do a lot of not only wind, but we also methane digesters and family wind farms in Minnesota, Alaska. Intertribal Coup has a stake in Native Energy, and we want other tribes to invest in it. And so someday that could be a completely 100% tribally owned business. So that's one of our goals.
Native Energy has a website. Also, we've got roughly about 10 minutes left, maybe 15 of questions. So go ahead.
This question is for Pat. In regards to everything you were just talking about in terms of transmission and adding different sources to the mix, are you or any of the groups that you work with looking at storage as a possible solution to some of those problems?
Yes, but not using the conventional batteries.
Will you repeat your question?
Oh, she said, are you looking at any type of storage for wind energy projects? There hasn't been large enough big batteries for storing wind. You've got to use it and burn the energy as you generate it. There's some work in that area that's being done that could be used for smaller individual or community projects. The batteries are getting better. Our proposal is to use the Missouri River as a huge battery. You can store energy in it. It's there already. If you don't use the hydropower and use the wind instead, you're storing energy. And so we have the largest battery of all the reservoir systems in the whole United States in the Missouri River. And so that's why we want WAPA and the Corps of Engineers to adopt a new paradigm of management of the river. Use the wind all the time, then add water, then get that guy shovel the coal only when it's 110 degrees out or something. You know, the wind's not up.
Are you talking about just using the existing dams as a hydro storage rather than actually doing adding an additional, forgetting the term, when it's up? Do you know what I mean? The the hydro storage that's currently used in some places, like for nuclear energy. Are you talking about building that on the Missouri River? Or are you talking?
No, we're not. We're not looking at building like large fuel cells or something or batteries or like
that. No, not a fuel cell. The hydro storage that's used in for energy storage currently.
Just keeping the water there and don't open the gates and turn the turbines when the wind's blowing when you don't need it. Add it. It's part of power scheduling, and there's technology there that's you know, you've heard of smart grids and smart technology. It's there. I've seen it. It's called management. You got to pay a little closer attention to what's going on in wind forecasting. When the wind's coming up and the waves coming across the prairie, surf's up. It's time to catch that. Pay attention. And we talked to some of the old boys in the utilities at management. Geez, that sounds like a lot of work, don't it? I say, yeah. We call that new jobs.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm Sarah Gilman from High Country News, and a lot of this discussion is focused on the misrepresentation in the press of tribes. And I wonder, this question is specifically directed towards Rob, a lot of tribal politics are very complicated with really stark divisions between community members and tribal governments, you know, with lots of accusations of corruption and stuff. The most stark example I can think of is probably the Navajo Nation and its proposal to build a 1,500 megawatt coal-fired power plant. And the Hopi and Navajo basically saying, we don't want any environmental groups on reservation. The tribe wants coal power. But in fact, there were a lot of tribal environmental groups fighting that plant as well. And so I wonder if you have any advice to the mainstream media in covering those big issues on how to navigate those politics and avoid using just the tribal government to represent all the people of the tribe. Because I think that's a really common thing that happens. Newspapers question.
Yeah, the question, so I don't repeat that. Very complicated, but covering conflict, hot conflict, very difficult. I agree. There's more points of view than just the government, but you got to be mindful of that, just as you would the county commissioners are pushing something, they're being attacked for it. I see people lose sight of that, and they lose sight of that the primary push of the tribal government kind of is a core issue that everything is reflective off of. What dynamic I see most often, and we experienced it with the medical marijuana story here, is that I have a list that I bring out. I talk to the college students, and it's don't swap in one, beware of assuming one tribe's opinions are interchangeable with another. What happened was, long and short of it, state of Montana allows medicinal marijuana use if you get the card. Our tribe decided to keep our direction and not acknowledge the state status on that. So if you're under our jurisdiction, i.e. a tribal member or a member of another federally recognized tribe on the reservation inside the boundaries, the card does not apply to you. It's like your subscription doesn't work or prescription does not work. These groups who are pro-marijuana showed up on the reservation with every Indian they could find saying things like, well, it's natural and it's part of the Native American experience that we can have marijuana. And we said, and so all these reporters came to our doorstep saying, well, we have these Indians saying that marijuana is acceptable and that you guys shouldn't accept it. I said, well, that's nice and well and good, but this is our homeland, this is our government, and we're running it, and this is what we say. And I would actually get kind of, well, these other Indians say it's okay. They're confused that why are the Indians having different opinions on this? I struggle with that response, that I believe that, well, if this one Indian says this and this Indian says that, well, you all, I don't know what the assumed presumption is that we're a monolithic other and we all walk the same footprint. And I just make that point again with a little more perspective. We're a very complex community. We have our angels, we have our troublemakers, we have our hellions, we have our saints. And they're all in the mix like any complex community. So people, when they report it, tend not to reflect the diversity within the community. They just kind of say, the Indians say, if you fall into that kind of paradigm, I can see why reporters get confused because we are not so simply defined.
Absolutely. You know, I've served on my tribal council as an elected tribal council member, something I'm very proud of, too. I think, and I'm also a director of a nonprofit organization on the reservation.
I would just like to make a point to note that nonprofit organizations are a really new thing in Indian country. This is, you know, very much different than the norm in this country. Nonprofit organizations are young, they're in their infancy, and I think the integrity of the tribe is paramount. So oftentimes, like the work I do as a nonprofit director, keeping the tribe together and looking at the greater good of the people, you have to keep that in mind, and also who is leading the cases, who's leading the charges on a specific issue. Families are very powerful in Indian country. Your extended family is huge. So like my mother, who's like the matriarch of our tribe, she's 86, one of the oldest living tribal members, speaks our language fluently, and I listen to her. If she doesn't want me to take on an issue, then I back off. If I'm on the tribal council or if I'm a director of a nonprofit, because we have to live together. We're a very small tribe. And when outsiders come in, oftentimes they're not clued into that, and sometimes they can be more destructive than helpful. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind as a nonprofit organization. Yeah, we'd like to have Sierra Club or all these other groups in here, but they're not in tune with our culture. They don't know who the elders are. They're not in tune with how we have to stay together here as a tribe. This is our last stand. This is our homeland. I have to worry about my nephew over here as well as this old lady over here in Bernie that doesn't even have indoor plumbing. So all these issues you take into mind as you go forward. So, you know, nonprofits are new. Tribal governments, clearly, when you're elected as a tribal leader, you have some power. There's a number of people who vote you in. Just like when I was elected, I had a big following that voted me in. So I represent those people. So, you know, tribal government is, we elect those people as our spokespersons. We have to respect them. They are who we are as sovereign nations. So, you know, all of that is basically to say that we're a cultural-based people, and we go with the flow of maintaining our identity and our homeland. We have to keep ourselves together.
Okay, thank you. I have another question. In the back.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for an enlightening panel discussion. My name is Rich Blaustein, freelance journalist. I'm doing a piece right now on the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People. And I was wondering, it is a document of land stewardship, so there's an energy connection. And I was wondering how much currency that the endorsing process, which is going on right now, has in the communities you work with. How well known it is.
Okay, so the question is, in all the tribal communities that you're familiar with, how much support is there for the UN Declaration?
How much support?
On the rights of indigenous peoples.
But how much of a priority to?
Yeah, and how much of a priority is it to educate people about that particular document?
I'm wavering between being having a smart response or being over the candy. This is one of those issues that I think is tremendous potential and is important, but I don't think it's one that permeates into the tribal communities that deeply. It strikes me more as one of those issues that, as a smartass, I would say, is kind of an issue embraced by the yuppie community, that they approach the tribes and think, well, you would think the tribes would embrace this. This is, you know, but I don't see it crossing through the barrier into our communities. It's just not kind of how we view the world. It doesn't align to our worldview or the daily challenges that the governments have. So I imagine you're speaking from a point of view of maybe confusion. Why aren't more folks jumping on board with this? And I think some people in our community are very attuned to it. We've got a very cultural tribal member who's very much in touch with the Maori and with this issue and with the Dalai Lama issue in our league. You know, he's coming to visit in a year. But there are individuals who have taken them. But as for governments themselves, I think this is probably down the priority list because it's the day-to-day issues that dominate demise.
And if I would just suggest that if you want some more input on that, just you can talk with our panelists afterwards. We have another panel waiting to get in the door. I just was told to thank everybody for coming and talk with our panelists later. Enjoy the rest of your...